We'll commence in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For the week beginning September 1, 2006, this is the Rain Report, the weekly audio ham radio program service of Rain, the Radio Amateur Information Network. I'm Neil Schaefer, AA9KK. This week we have a double feature. We'll hear a short interview with Henry Feinberg, K2SSQ, the ham who designed the space communicator for the movie E.T. But first, an interview Rain producer Hap Holly, KC9RP, conducted with Ray Novak, N9JA, product manager for the receiver and amateur division of ICOM America. The topic is D-Star, digital smart technology for amateur radio. It very well could be the most important development in amateur radio since FM repeaters. Here's part one of that interview.
D-Star is an open protocol developed for the JARL, which is a Japanese Amateur Radio League. Probably in the late 1990s, early 2000, the JARL sent out a request for quote to the amateur radio manufacturers to take amateur radio into the 21st century. In doing that, they wanted to focus on the concept of digital radio being more spectrum efficient, as well as tying into what we saw as threats to the amateur industry, and that would be the Internet as well. ICOM was very vital in working with the JARL to create this technology. We are the first manufacturer to provide products for this protocol.
Why did ICOM get involved and the others have not?
I really don't know an accurate answer to that. I would think more of, from my personal understanding of the industry, it was more of a personal challenge to Mr. Inouye to remember the roots of where ICOM was started, and that was amateur radio. We see a lot of distractions from other industries, such as a commercial two-way, but ICOM has stayed steadfast in the roots and has done as much as possible to develop new product for the amateur radio industry.
Why is D-Star technology important?
The JARL realized that amateur radio had lost its technological edge. We were really no longer the test bed of technology. So they looked at what around them could be used to develop amateur radio and bring us back to the forefront. In my travels to Japan, I've noticed, and it's catching on in the United States, of seeing the youth texting their friends with their cell phone, or streaming video, or listening to music downloads and things like this. They really saw the new technology was in net type and data type movement. So what they did in D-Star is they combined digital voice technology as well as the ability to move data. When we take a look at what D-Star allows us to do, and we're mainly going to just focus on the VHF and UHF portion of it, with today's repeater network that D-Star has a capability of doing, we are able to link repeaters together, and not only link them together, but we're able to do it as a user type routing rather than a site type routing. An example would be Echolink and IRLP. Those are site linked systems. I have to know what node I want to talk to, or if I wanted to talk to a particular person, I would have to know what node they are on. D-Star is a user routed base. All I have to know is your call sign, Hap, and whether you're in Chicago or at Dayton Hamvention or traveling throughout the United States, the communications from me to you will go to the last known repeater that you are operating on. And I would then be able to talk to you and not have to worry if you're traveling or if you're back at home in Chicago. There are several things that could be done on a D-Star repeater. One of them that we've seen the most interest in has been for emergency communications. I know today we have our traditional analog FM repeaters. We also have our separate Digipete network that we do APRS with. What we were able to do in a demonstration for FEMA and the United States Army was solve probably one of their largest issues, and that is knowing who's talking to them and where they are at the same time. With D-Star, since we're transmitting data, if you have a GPS tied to the radio, somebody in a first responder role could go, "I need help." The radio will ID the call sign, and with the GPS attached to it, it will transmit the GPS coordinates all on the same frequency. That way, a dispatcher, instead of having to write down the call sign, make sure they have it proper, and then going and looking at an APRS map, they can have all that information come up to them on their dispatch software. The voice they hear will match with the call sign and the location that appears on their computer monitor. So the communications then become more efficient. Instead of, "Joe, I need help out here." "Well, Pete, where are you?" I don't know, because the landmarks are demolished or the street signs are underwater. The GPS coordinates make it very efficient. You can say, I need a fire department dispatched here, and then everything is already communicated at that point.
What equipment is available today in the amateur market for D-Star?
Right now, ICOM has produced infrastructure components, which include a repeater controller, digital voice modules for 2-meter, 70-centimeter, and 23-centimeter, and then we also have a 128K data package available on the 23-centimeter as well. On the user side, we have a VHF-UHF portable, a dual-band portable, a 2-meter mobile, as well as a dual-band mobile. The dual bands are 2-meter and 70 centimeters. We do have a mobile that will do 23 centimeter as well.
I'm speaking today with Ray Novak, N9JA, the Division Manager for Amateur and Receiver Products with ICOM America. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
Let's talk about the politics of D-Star technology. I would imagine that one point of resistance is from those who would say, well, my FM transceiver does just fine on repeaters, and I don't see why I should have to spend a gazillion dollars to get a D-Star radio that may or may not make a difference in my amateur radio hobby.
That is exactly true. What we're seeing is D-Star might not be for everybody. But one of the things that we're seeing in the fastest growing segment of our hobby is our role as first responder communicators for emergency communications. What we were able to identify during our tests with FEMA and the United States Army was we have become a more important player in search and rescue efforts by being able to do something very simple, and that is efficiently communicate our location, our need, and who we are just by one simple push to talk, instead of a lot of miscommunications trying to understand the phonetics, the call signs, and things like that. We can help people who are new in communications to be able to understand and have a more effective role. I feel, and there's a few others that have been playing around with it, feel that this is the next huge evolution for amateur radio. It can be compared to the change of spark gap to AM. AM to sideband, then sideband to FM, and FM to digital. We're seeing every other piece of communications go digital. I would find it hard to believe that a lot of people out there would want to see amateur radio stay back while everything else is progressing beyond what we're capable of doing.
Ray, here in the Chicago area, there is some movement politically towards putting up a D-Star repeater. Does this mean I would have to have two radios in my vehicle, one for the traditional FM repeater and one for D-Star, or can I get both in one radio?
When we first started developing the product for the D-Star protocol, we realized that there would be an upgrade path needed. In doing that, we looked at the people that were using the traditional modes of FM and those that wanted to use both. Instead of creating a radio that was either analog or digital, all of our radios currently have both modes either built in or available as an upgrade. When people first look at the cost of getting into a digital radio, they kind of have a little bit of a sticker shock. But when you look beyond the initial pricing and compare it to where amateur radio was, say, 10 years ago, the cost of the radio is actually about the same. I've talked to people who have, say, an IC229, an old 2-meter mobile that many of us have either owned at least one of these, probably spent around $400 10 years ago. Well, to take a 2-meter mobile, say like the 2200H, you can buy one of those just in analog mode for well under $200. To upgrade it to where it was both analog and digital capable would be roughly another $200. But the total package would be under $400. The dual-band handheld selections are the IC91A and the IC91AD. The 91A is analog with digital upgrade by plugging in a board. The price of that is around $369.95. The dual-bander with the D-Star digital module already built in is the IC91AD. That one is $425.95. So when you take a look at prices today compared to 10 years ago, they're pretty much back at the same level. But you have a whole new unexplored, undeveloped world available to you.
That was part one of an interview Hap Holly, KC9RP, conducted with Ray Novak, N9JA, product manager for the receiver and amateur division of ICOM America, on the subject of D-STAR, digital smart technology for amateur radio. We'll bring you the conclusion of this important interview next week. In the meantime, it's time for another station ID before we bring you our second feature. This is the Rain Report.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
While Henry Feinberg, K2SSQ, may not be a household name, one of many props he designed will be recognized by virtually any ham that has watched the beloved movie E.T. Henry designed the E.T. communicator. As he told Amateur Radio Newsline's Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, his creative inclinations began with his getting involved in the NBC Science TV program, Mr. Wizard.
I was a physics major at New York University. There on the bulletin board was a notice for a laboratory assistant to work on a science television program, unnamed. Well, I took that notice right off the bulletin board and marched in and applied for the job, was interviewed. A couple weeks later, got the job. It was that easy. The first thing that I made after I found out it was Mr. Wizard, I had watched that program for while growing up, was to take a piece of oak tag, make it into a cone, stick a darning needle on the end of it, and use that as a phonograph player. So I can see, you can see how dated the program was at that time. But I stayed with the show for 8 years and became associate producer of the show and had quite a nice career.
It also changed your career. You were a physics major, and all of a sudden you found yourself going in a different direction, didn't you?
That's right. Well, the title of the show, the subtitle was The Magic and Mystery of Science in Everyday Living. And I was enthralled with the possibilities of communicating science to other people. My enthusiasm faded. So I changed my major to communication arts. With a minor in education, that's where it's gone ever since.
Tell us a little bit about some of the experiments that you put together for the show. You mentioned the phonograph. Anything else come to mind?
Well, there were a number of things. The important thing to realize was the show was live. It was a half hour long. What was done went out. Even when we started to videotape, it was a very low-budget show. You've heard the expression, live on tape. That means that when the show started, the tape machine started, and a half hour later, the tape machine stopped, and whatever happened in between, that was the show. So there were times when I was under the table holding wires together, or things that went a little bit different from the walkthrough or rehearsal and the actual airing. It was an exciting time.
And that kind of led you to your next step in your career. I know you did some films, and then you went over to Bell Labs.
That's right. I was hired at Bell Labs as a documentary writer-director and did a series of films there talking about science as a science interpreter, talking about the advances in science and technology that at that time the Bell system was deep into. That, again, was a very exciting time for me.
You said you did some films, but then I know your career went in another direction doing displays and things. How did that all come about?
Well, it's just another way of film, television, documentaries, and then exhibits. Became the big push at Bell Laboratories, and it was just another way of displaying the wares, you might say. It's a different technique for describing how the backgrounds, the science behind the products worked and the technologies. That, too, used a host of communication skills. It was a challenge. We had a lot of fun. I could have made a lot more money in other things, but as I said, I wouldn't have had as much fun.
A lot of that was done down in, at the Epcot, because Bell was involved with the development of the original Epcot displays, wasn't it?
AT&T was the sponsor at Spaceship Earth at Epcot Center. And then again, after the second generation of Epcot, of interventions, there were a number of exhibits talking about leading-edge technologies. And we also worked with the Disney Imagineers in designing the Spaceship Earth ride, the ride through the history of communications.
Working on the history of communications took you to another strange realm for a while of becoming a prop maker for a very famous movie, didn't it?
Well, that was something else that happened at Bell Labs. Again, the use of everyday objects to explain scientific phenomenon at the Mr. Wizard show became very handy when Steven Spielberg's group called Bell Labs to ask for aid in producing props for his E.T. film. And at that time, Spielberg was the bad boy of Hollywood. Although Bell Laboratories worked with Stanley Kubrick on 2001 earlier, it was beneath them to work on props for a science fiction movie like E.T. So they asked if I would handle that on my own, and the rest is history.
The movie, I think it was called The Boy and His Dog or something, is his working title, and when it hit the theaters, it just became like one of the biggest of all time.
Well, the working title was actually The Boy's Life, and then became E.T., the extraterrestrial. It was a challenge to produce an actual working space communicator out of household parts.
As I recall, some bought at the Dayton Convention.
That's right. There were a number of things. I saw the cantennas there, used that concept. I saw an umbrella there. I used that concept, putting things together in a way that would be enjoyable, using the household parts, but understandable for everybody that watches it.
Were you surprised when that movie just went thunk right to the top?
Well, I wasn't surprised. I mean, I had great thoughts about the movie. I think what was a surprise was the turnaround of AT&T after saying, farming this out to this guy who works here, saying, gee, didn't we do a great job inventing this?
So they took credit, at least part of the credit for it. How many of those communicators are in existence? Weren't there some built for museums and displays around the world?
Yes, I built several. There is one on display right now still, I think, at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. There are a number at science centers around the United States.
Do you ever get any calls? Hey, can we get one of these?
Well, actually, I still get calls occasionally from science classes who want to put together a model of that type of communicator, ask for details of how that was done. So it has a life of its own.
Could it possibly be made to work?
I have certification from the IEEE that, in fact, it does work. It actually produces a signal and transmits it at microwave energy into outer space or wherever the antenna is aimed.
Has anybody ever held a QSO with it?
No. Remember, it's a beacon transmitter, so there was no receive capability.
From there, you went back to doing displays for Bell and AT&T, and then you changed careers again.
Yeah, that's right. I retired from AT&T. Right now, I have become a science teacher, a long-term substitute science teacher teaching seventh-grade science, and boy, is that a kick.
Henry Feinberg, K2SSQ, the man behind the ET communicator. He was interviewed by Amateur Radio Newsline's Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. And that's a wrap for this double shot of Rain. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2006 Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Neil Schaefer, AA9KK.